Good afternoon. It's great to see such a plentiful crowd this afternoon for our esteemed guests from the Seventh Circuit. 2012 was, I think, a banner year for books for, for law nerds, kind of like me and maybe many of you, I don't know. Books about the Constitution and about judging and the role of the courts. A few that we could name, there's The Oath by Jeffrey Toobin about the Obama White House and the Supreme Court. There is a lengthy biography of Judge Henry Friendly by David Dorson. Akhil Amar has a new edition with America's Unwritten Constitution, the precedents and principles we live by. Perhaps the one that's most famous for this group is the book Reading Law, The Interpretation of Legal Text by Justice Scalia and Brian Garner. This is the book that gave rise to many, many book reviews and some lengthy book reviews and some very skeptical book reviews. And it was a defense of originalism and some judicial canons of interpretation, but it gave rise to this intellectual scrapping with Judge Posner. And the most, I think, the most apt description of this exchange that I saw was at Above the Law, where they called it a case of mutual bench, B-E-N-C-H, bench slapping. Well, today we're going to discuss another interesting book on the philosophy of law published in 2012. It's this thin volume. Fourth Circuit Judge Harvey Wilkinson wrote it. It's called Cosmic Constitutional Theory, Why Americans Are Losing Their Inalienable Right to Self-Governance. Wilkinson, many of you may know of him, is a Reagan appointee. He was interviewed by President Bush, George W. Bush, for the Supreme Court vacancy created by the retirement of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And in this book, he speaks of cosmic theory in the sense of exploring theories of constitutional interpretation that purport to restrain the judicial role while providing a method to try to answer all constitutional questions. But I will say there is a decidedly mawkish tone to the title, for Wilkinson soon makes it clear that, in his view, the search for a unified field theory of constitutional interpretation is a fool's errand. He critiques several theories, living constitutionalism, originalism, political process theory, and even pragmatism, which I think has been made famous in more recent years. Judge Wilkinson gets around at the end of the book, after he critiques these theories, to answering the question, okay, so what does work? And I don't want to spoil the end, but it's a bit disappointing. So the question we ask today, is Wilkinson properly announcing the death of jurisprudence? So we have today to offer their insights two bona fide all-stars of the federal judiciary who on a daily basis must make sense of the legal cosmos of which Judge Wilkinson writes. Judge Diane Sykes earned a B.S. degree in journalism at Northwestern University in 1980, a J.D. at Marquette University in 1984. After law school, Judge Sykes clerked for Judge Terry Evans at the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, who, of course, later was elevated to the Seventh Circuit. She was in private practice from 1985 to 1992 in Milwaukee and won election to the Milwaukee County Circuit Court in 1992. After being appointed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1999, she was elected to that court, well, where she served until her appointment to the Seventh Circuit in 2004. President George W. Bush nominated Sykes to the Seventh Circuit in November 2003. She was confirmed in June 2004 and became the first judge appointed to the Seventh Circuit by President Bush. Judge Hamilton earned a bachelor's degree from Haverford College in 1979, followed by a JD from Yale Law School in 1983. He clerked for Seventh Circuit Judge Cudahy, then practiced locally at Barnes and Thornburg until 1989. He served as legal counsel to Indiana Governor Evan Bayh from 1989 until 1991, then returned to Barnes as a partner until becoming a federal judge in 1994. On March 17, 2009, President Barack Obama made Hamilton his first, very first federal court nominee, nominating him for vacancy on the Seventh Circuit created by Judge Kenneth Ripple's decision to take senior status. The Senate approved Judge Hamilton's nomination in November of 2009. Well, I think it's no exaggeration to say that both Judges Sykes and Hamilton are held in the highest esteem by both lawyers practicing before them and all who appreciate scholarly, rigorous, and disciplined approach to judging, whether they are on the winning side or the losing side of any of their decisions. Yet I suspect that they approach their jobs with different jurisprudential commitments. It's certainly true they were appointed by presidents of different political parties and who I think fairly we can say have contrasting views of the role of the judiciary. So with that, we'll start with Judge Sykes and we'll hear about their views on Harvey Wilkinson's cosmic constitutional theory. Welcome.
Thank you, Tom. First of all, let me say that David and I never engage in mutual bench slapping. I appreciate
even when we disagree.
That's right. I really appreciate the invitation to be with you today, and especially the invitation to talk about Judge Wilkinson's new book, which I think, and I think will become apparent as I move through my remarks this afternoon. It comes at a very important time and makes a very important contribution. One of the recurring themes, of course, in our perennial debate about constitutional adjudication is the role of judicial restraint. But the issue rarely breaks through to the public consciousness. It tends to come up in confirmation hearings for Supreme Court justices, and also sometimes in state Supreme Court elections. Nominees for the Supreme Court and candidates for the state Supreme Courts are often questioned about their commitment to judicial restraint in an effort to expose activist tendencies. I have firsthand experience with that as a candidate for the state Supreme Court in 2000. The issue sometimes also finds its way into the public discourse when the Supreme Court issues a closely divided decision in a hotly contested and politically charged case raising a constitutional challenge to an important law. You may recall that we had one of those just this past June. The role of judicial restraint has been a prominent theme in some of the early analysis of the Supreme Court's divided decision in the healthcare case. In particular, the Chief Justice's application of the doctrine of constitutional avoidance has come under special scrutiny. Even the President has entered the fray. He has raised the issue of judicial restraint in a controversial, or at least an unusual, way. He pointedly criticized the Supreme Court's free speech decision in the Citizens United case during his State of the Union address in 2010, accusing the court of abandoning judicial restraint. And after oral argument in the healthcare case last spring, while the case was under advisement, he publicly challenged the court not to take what he said would be the unprecedented, extraordinary step of overturning his signature law. When the President of the United States confronts the court so explicitly, the general public is bound to sit up and take notice. The court's docket this term is certain to intensify the spotlight on the issue of judicial restraint. Among other high-stakes cases, the court will decide challenges to affirmative action and the Voting Rights Act. And with the cert grants in the marriage cases last week, judicial restraint will remain in the public eye, and certainly on the minds of all of us in the bench, bar, and legal academy. All this is simply to reiterate that Judge Wilkinson's book is both timely and important. It arrives at a pivotal time in our law and politics, and because it comes from one of our nation's most highly regarded federal appellate judges, it deserves our very serious reflection. Before the Supreme Court issued the healthcare decision in June, our colleague Judge Posner published a very interesting article in the California Law Review entitled "The Rise and Fall of Judicial Self-Restraint." He focused on a particular kind of restraint, the judicial policy premised on respect for the other branches of government that legislative and executive actions should be upheld against constitutional challenge unless their invalidity is clear beyond doubt. Judge Posner pronounces this kind of judicial restraint dead, at least as a philosophical commitment of today's Supreme Court, although he does suggest that it might continue to function as a trace element in the justice's behavior. Judge Wilkinson doesn't go quite that far. For him, judicial restraint is not dead, but it is seriously endangered. His thesis, as you have just heard, is that the rise of constitutional theory in the post-New Deal era is displacing the time-honored practice of judicial deference to the political branches of government, providing intellectual cover for judicial adventurism and threatening to choke off democratic self-governance. He makes a very thoughtful case for restoring restraint as a defining judicial virtue. Now, before getting into the heart of Judge Wilkinson's argument on behalf of restraint, let me say a few words about the specific constitutional theories he identifies as its biggest threat. There are four culprits, although two of them are no longer in active use. The other two, originalism and pragmatism, are the current competitors, so I'll spend most of my time on those. Because our time is limited today, please forgive my overgeneralization and oversimplification. I won't take up specific illustrative cases. I think Judge Hamilton may do some of that, and I may chime in later on. Judge Wilkinson first takes aim at the theory known as living constitutionalism, practiced most prominently by the Warren Court and particularly by Justice Brennan, and perhaps contrasted most starkly by the jurisprudence of Justice Scalia, who likes to say that he interprets the dead Constitution. The basic idea behind this school of legal thought is that the Constitution evolves to reflect contemporary understandings of the core principles contained in the majestic provisions of the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment. This evolutionary approach authorizes judges to implement contemporary values and adapt the Constitution's broad language to modern conditions and problems. In practice, this theory produced the rights revolution of the Warren Court, continuing under the Burger Court, and was aggressively interventionist in implementing liberal social, political, and legal reform by judicial decree. As Judge Wilkinson explains in the book, the results were in some cases a virtue and in some cases a vice. But in all cases, the theory empowered judges to deploy the Constitution as a malleable instrument of social and legal change, according to their own lights and at the expense of the democratic process. It produced a conservative counter-revolution, about which more in a moment. I will take only a very brief detour into political process theory, which, as Judge Wilkinson himself notes, was pretty much confined to the legal academy and never really caught on with judges. It basically sought to reorient the jurisprudence of the Warren Court around the idea that judges ought to focus less on achieving certain preferred substantive outcomes and more on ensuring that the political process functions fairly and preventing political majorities from oppressing minorities. It's enough for our purposes here today to say that this theory suffers from the same defects as living constitutionalism in that its legal basis is unclear and it shifts considerable unconstrained power to the judiciary. Judge Wilkinson's chapters on originalism and pragmatism are the heart of his book, and it is here that his influence will be most felt. The effects of living constitutionalism are embedded in many aspects of our doctrine, but as an approach to constitutional interpretation, it has long since receded from the scene. Originalism and pragmatism are the two main theories of constitutional interpretation currently in use by judges. Judge Wilkinson's chapter on originalism expands his early critique of the Supreme Court's decision in District of Columbia versus Heller, the Second Amendment case. His chapter on legal pragmatism focuses primarily on the eminent Judge Posner, our colleague, its most prominent and prolific practitioner. Let's take originalism first. Judge Wilkinson briefly discusses the foundational contributions of Chief Justice John Marshall and, to a lesser extent, Justice Hugo Black, but he quickly moves to Judge Bork's exposition of the textualist originalist theory of constitutional interpretation in response to the Warren Court and explains how it gained acceptance in the legal academy, even among liberal scholars, and then eventually took root at the Supreme Court. Much of this discussion presents originalism in a positive light. For the uninitiated, and there are probably a few of you in the room, although probably only a few, the animating principle of originalism arise from the legal justification for the power of judicial review, the judicial duty to decide cases according to law. Briefly stated, the basic theory is this. Because our Constitution is written, unlike the British Constitution, and because it is supreme law adopted by the people as the original sovereign that brought the American government into being, constitutional interpretation ought to be grounded in the original public meaning of the text as understood at the time of ratification. On this view, constitutional adjudication begins with an inquiry into the meaning and scope of the provision in question, based on the constitutional text and structure and the historical evidence of its original public meaning. As Judge Wilkinson explains in the book, more than any other theory, originalism focuses on judicial restraint because it recognizes that ultimate legal authority stems from sources external to the judge. Originalism legitimizes judicial review and provides a concrete foundation for analysis by setting boundaries on judicial discretion based on the text, structure, and history of the Constitution at the time of ratification. He acknowledges that in theory, originalism has the potential to constrain judges and strengthen their resolve to show restraint. But he ultimately concludes that the theory has failed to deliver on its initial promise, largely because judges are amateur historians and the text and historical indicators of original meaning are all too often inconclusive. He concedes that there is nothing intrinsically wrong with gaps between theory and practice. Indeed, he writes, they are unavoidable. What matters is whether the gap between theory and practice leads to salutary outcomes or detrimental ones. And in his view, with originalism, the outcomes are anything but salutary. The Supreme Court's decisions in Heller and the follow-on case of McDonald versus City of Chicago, which incorporated the Second Amendment right against the states, are exhibits A and B in Judge Wilkinson's catalog of bad outcomes. To put it mildly, he is decidedly unpersuaded by the court's historical analysis. In his view, the original meaning of the Second Amendment is transparently contestable. So for him, Heller and McDonald are prime examples of how originalism preys on the natural weakness of judges, the tendency to substitute their own preferences for those of the Constitution. In the end, he writes, the close historical questions that often arise in originalist analysis are vulnerable to subconscious thumbs on the scale. There is a note of sorrow here. As I have noted, he writes admiringly of originalism and finds it immensely sad that a theory that was boldly advertised at its inception as a constraining force on the judiciary has been hijacked for unrestrained excursions into the prerogatives of the other branches of government. Finally, Judge Wilkinson turns to Judge Posner's pragmatic approach to judging, which he describes as an anti-theoretical response to the various unifying theories of constitutional interpretation that have arisen in the post-New Deal era. To vastly oversimplify, Judge Posner's legal pragmatism is a flexible approach to judging that focuses on the consequences of judicial decisions for the parties and for the broader economic, social, and political systems. The object is to achieve good outcomes. Judge Posner does not limit himself to the usual authoritative sources of law. I was waiting for that to sink in. I know that comes as no surprise to those of you who practice in our court. When the traditional legal materials do not answer the question in the case, or when they produce an unsatisfactory answer, the pragmatist judge will weigh the costs and benefits of the various decisional options and choose the best one. Judge Posner thinks it best that we candidly acknowledge that when the law is underdeterminate, as it sometimes is, the judge is acting essentially as a discretionary lawmaker. This calls for careful attention to the facts of the case, which will illuminate the consequences of a decision for one side or the other, and empirical evidence, which helps explain the systemic consequences of the range of possible outcomes. Based on the available evidence, the pragmatist judge should choose the one that best achieves good overall outcomes. Not surprisingly, Judge Wilkinson faults pragmatism for its explicit judge-empowering premises. Whereas originalism tethers judges to constitutional text, structure, and history, traditional legal materials whose democratic imprimatur cannot be questioned if properly discerned and relevantly applied, with pragmatism, he writes, there is no tether at all. In his last chapter, as Tom mentioned, Judge Wilkinson argues for an escape from all this theory and a return to judicial restraint as a check against the perils of judicial supremacy and its interference with democratic choice. I detect a nod to originalism here. There's a sense in his summation that he thinks originalist theory might have a role to play if only it could be trusted to channel restraint. Judge Wilkinson is a traditionalist and a moderate conservative. He sees judicial restraint as a mediating influence between the extremes of the progressive and libertarian visions of the Constitution now contending in the legal battlefield. He closes with an eloquent plea for judicial humility. He writes, "Theory-driven judges and scholars have forgotten that wisdom lies simply in knowing the limits of one's knowledge, the good that good sense is more often displayed in collective and diverse settings than in a rarefied appellate atmosphere, and that the language, structure, and history of law serve best as mediums of restraint rather than excuses for intrusion." I have long admired Judge Wilkinson's work and hold him in the highest possible esteem. So I was not at all surprised to find myself agreeing with much of what he had to say in Cosmic Constitutional Theory. Restraint in the exercise of judicial power is indeed a virtue. Judicial mistakes on constitutional questions are extraordinarily difficult to fix. Arrogating too much power to the judiciary is destabilizing to our political and legal order. It disturbs the balance in the constitutional design, distorts our politics, and undermines our ability to democratically shape and alter our basic legal, civil, social, and economic institutions. So I share Judge Wilkinson's view that the responsibility of judicial review is so consequential that it's best to take the long view of our nation's history and proceed with a clear-eyed understanding of the constitutional limits on the judicial role and the prudential limits of judicial competence. Where I part company with Judge Wilkinson is in his claim that all modern theories of constitutional law are inconsistent with a proper understanding of the judicial role and ought to be resisted in favor of judicial restraint, understood as a general policy of deference to the political branches. Deference is owed when deference is due, and a default position of judicial non-intervention doesn't answer the question of when precisely it is right to defer. Or to be more specific, it answers the question in a way that invites judges to decline to correct unconstitutional exercises of authority by the other branches of government. And that is contrary to the essence of judicial duty. The duty of judicial review requires some method of constitutional interpretation. Precedent will answer many questions, but not all. And sometimes precedents are wrong. The Supreme Court regularly decides cases for which there is no controlling precedent. That just goes with the territory. And at the Court of Appeals, we are called upon to decide quite a few cases in this category. Doctrinal development in the hard cases often requires us to return to first principles. Adjudicating constitutional questions necessarily requires a decision method for resolving how the Constitution should be interpreted and applied. Deference is not a method of interpretation, nor is it an implementing doctrine that enforces the structural provisions of the Constitution or gives effect to the liberty guarantees of the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment. Restraint is a venerable principle, but it cannot do all or even most of the work in constitutional adjudication. It simply does not address itself to the meaning, scope, or application of the fixed and enduring principles of our written Constitution. Originalism does so, and more than any other theory of constitutional interpretation, it makes sense of the justification for the power of judicial review. We all know our Marbury versus Madison. The judiciary's authority to set aside an otherwise valid law in the name of the Constitution arises only by inference from the judiciary's duty to apply the law, including the law of the Constitution, in individual cases. As faithful judicial interpreters, our inquiry into the law of the Constitution ought to be grounded in the principles the framers and ratifiers fixed in its text and structure. Implementing doctrine has an important role to play, but Judge Wilkinson is entirely right that by anchoring constitutional adjudication in the text, structure, and history of the Constitution, originalism best legitimizes judicial review. In many ways, Judge Wilkinson's book captures the evolution of the conservative legal movement and the transition that has been underway for some time now, but has only more recently emerged in the decisions of the Supreme Court. In its early years, the primary concern was to stand athwart the jurisprudence of the Warren Court yelling, stop. Apologies to William F. Buckley. Thus, the emphasis on judicial restraint, understood as deference to the policies and value judgments of the political branches of government, as a check against judicial supremacy. But the initial emphasis on deference did not address how the Constitution ought to be read, interpreted, and applied. That would come later, as originalism was developed and refined. Now restraint is understood as deference to the Constitution, rather than to the subordinate law made by contemporary politicians. The old and new understandings of restraint will be in tension this term as the Supreme Court works its way through the historic and consequential cases on its docket. Judge Wilkinson's contribution to reconciling that tension is most welcome. Thank you very much for your attention this afternoon.
Thank you, Judge Sykes. Judge Hamilton.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. Good afternoon. And thank you all very much for the invitation to join you this afternoon and to join my colleague, Diane Sykes. There is no one with whom I enjoy working more. We don't always agree, but we always get along and in our both privately and publicly. I'd like to thank those of you responsible for this event that I know about, including Brian Paul and Tom Fisher and Jeff Slaughter, for your work. I'd also like to note I brought along what somebody described as my cheering section. I don't know if it's going to turn out that way, but my father, Dick Hamilton, sister Lisa Hamilton, and her husband, Dave Hensel, a longtime member of this group, are here, as are my current law clerks who are spread around the room. Thank you all for being here. It was a treat for me to read Judge Wilkinson's book. It brought to mind a couple of stories. In his focus on originalism, he decides to focus on Judge Bork as his primary sparring partner in this. Professor Bork was my constitutional law professor. That may come as a shock to some of you who know my work. when Bork was teaching us, he told us a story about when he was a 1L student at Chicago taking constitutional law. According to him, as I recall, he didn't attend class very much, or at least didn't do much of the reading. So he decided to prepare for the final exam by reading the text of the Constitution the night before, very carefully. Mm-hmm. According to him, that really wasn't sufficient for the final exam that he had to take. And he advised us that as committed a textualist as he was, he didn't suggest we follow that approach for his final exam either. A couple of years later, after Professor Bork had been appointed to the D.C. Circuit, he came back to New Haven once a week to teach a seminar on theories of judicial review, which I had the opportunity to sit in on. It was fascinating to work through these various theories as they had developed up to that point 30 years ago. As I recall it, about half the class generally agreed with Professor Judge Bork at that time. And they all went to work for the Justice Department under President Reagan and later Attorney General Meese. The other half of the class didn't buy into his theories quite as completely, and we scattered to the four winds. But that group included future Professor Akhil Amar, who was then a 2L student, rather precocious, and the author of this year's America's Unwritten Constitution, a title that I'm sure causes heart palpitations among Professor Bork and others who are concerned about that. And just in case you think that Judge Posner has only been sparring with Justice Scalia this year, you ought to see his review of America's Unwritten Constitution. promiscuous is one of the verbs, one of the adjectives that figures in that discussion. I mentioned these just to say that these are old debates, and these debates are continuing. But since law school, I have to say, I spent relatively little time following the ins and outs of the latest debates. I never found any of these theories terribly satisfactory and therefore love Judge Wilkinson's book, as he criticizes so many of these theories. What I've been doing for the last 30 years as a lawyer and then as a judge, in, as far as constitutional law goes, is doing it. And Wilkinson is a guy who just does it. He has pulled together, as Judge Sykes has laid out, critiques of the principal theories that as well as identifying their virtues. And he emphasizes the virtues of judicial restraint. Does he have a theory of his own? He denies it. I think there is one. It's implicit. But it is not certainly a cosmic theory. At the risk, he might not accept this this characterization, but I would suggest that a lot of Judge Wilkinson's emphasis on judicial restraint is based on what Professor Charles Black, who was in essence Bork's more liberal counterpart teaching con law to our class 30 plus years ago, would have called constitutional law by structure and relationship. The principles of judicial restraint derive from structures and relationships among branches of government established by the Constitution. We begin with the counter-majoritarian problem. What justifies judges, elite members of one particular profession, overriding the decisions of the democratically elected branches of government? We work with a text that invites interpretation and elaboration in case law. That's a major part of the problem and a major part of the need for judicial restraint. We have courts that depend upon public acceptance of our decisions in the long run. You can see this in Justice Breyer's writing. He's laid out the points quite persuasively, in my view, about the need for the Supreme Court and other federal courts to worry a lot about preserving our legitimacy and the public acceptance of our decisions. Most important for Wilkinson, as I read him, is that we are a government of the people, for the people, but most of all, by the people. So the elected branches of government need to be able to exercise public choice. You know, let the theoretical debates continue as far as Judge Wilkinson is concerned, but there are not many situations, if we want to promote government by the people, not many situations where it's appropriate for a court to look at a field of public debate and, in essence, sweep all the chessmen from the board and declare one side the winner once and for all as a matter of constitutional law. There are a few areas where he is willing to do that, where he sees it as our clear obligation. But we don't need to solve all problems under the aegis of constitutional law. I would suggest that where Wilkinson is headed in this is what I would call a concept of, I'm going to borrow this phrase, of ordinary judging. I'm borrowing it from Professor Bill Popkin of IU's law school, who has used that phrase to describe a method of statutory interpretation. But I think it also applies in large part to constitutional adjudication, just on a bigger stage and with somewhat fewer restraints. Of course, we all begin with the text, the original meaning, the public understanding. By the way, if any of you want to see that methodology illustrated as recently as yesterday, I urge you to take a look at a decision that our court issued yesterday called Moore versus Madigan, a split decision striking down Illinois' prohibitions on carrying guns in public. Judge Posner wrote a majority opinion. Judge Williams wrote a dissent. To give you an idea, there is a fascinating discussion about original meaning of the Second Amendment as applied to carrying guns, arms in public, focusing on the statute of Northumberland, personally I had never heard of, which became law in England in 1328 and made it a crime to go about armed in public unless you were fit within certain narrow exceptions. You could be imprisoned at the discretion, at the pleasure of the king. That's the way that worked at that time. I'm not sure how that fits in with the rest of our Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and as it may apply to criminal procedure. But these are very lively issues, very current. Beyond text and original public meaning, of course, we also deal with precedent and doctrine as it evolves. Wilkinson points out, for example, some of the non-originalist, non-textual decisions that I suspect at this point enjoy virtually universal support. Brown versus Board of Education, not originalist. Gideon versus Wainwright, certainly not originalist or textualist, to give the right to counsel in all in any felony cases. Reynolds versus Sims, one person, one vote in legislative districts so as to ensure, before at least the development of sophisticated gerrymandering computer programs, representation as fair as possible. But to prevent state senators from representing, for example, populations that differed by a factor of more than 10 or even 20. Miranda, not a textualist decision, not an originalist decision, but one that has now reached deep acceptance in our society and has taken hold so that its original opponents have accepted it, as you saw in Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinion in the Dickerson case. Text, original intent, precedent, doctrine, concern about the structures and relationships among different branches can take you a very long way. They will not always answer the questions. You can have lots of debates within the framework that those set up, and those are the kinds of things that Judge Sykes and I and those of you in this room deal with every day, every week. But when you have to go beyond that, there is, I think this is what Judge Wilkinson is getting at, a need to focus on the institutional competences that courts have. We need to focus on what you can call ordinary judging or good old-fashioned legal analysis. Focus on the things that are the key elements of the rule of law: interpretation and application of public sources of law, done through a public explanation for which the authors are accountable to explain themselves, rules that will be indifferent as between different parties, and a willingness to apply rules generally. Those are what I think of as they're not original, obviously, but what I've learned to recognize as the key aspects of a genuine rule of law: close analysis of precedent through those processes, accountability to the learned members of our profession, provide significant, meaningful restraints on any individual judges or panels or courts' discretion, ultimately backed up by the potential of public resistance to courts' decisions. Those all, I think, provide sound and appropriate bases for judicial restraint, even if they are not a guarantee that you will never disagree with a court's decision or never find a particular panel or court going beyond its warrant. To illustrate this, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about two cases from our court that were both argued on the same day, September 13th, 2011, before a panel of Judge Posner presiding, Judge Sykes to his right, and me to his left. They produced a couple, I hope you'll find them interesting. One case is ACLU of Chicago versus Alvarez. For those keeping notes, it's 679 F3rd 583. An Illinois law made it a crime to record the audio of a person in a conversation without consent of everyone involved in the conversation. The question was whether that violates the First Amendment as applied to audio recordings of police officers doing their work in public. Judge Sykes and I agreed, in a great opinion by Judge Sykes, that law violated the First Amendment. Judge Posner dissented. The Supreme Court denied cert a couple of weeks ago I note that I did happen to have on MSNBC that night, and Lawrence O'Donnell was lavish in his praise of Judge Sykes' opinion. So.
Red letter day. Oh,
you want to erase that part of the tape after this, that's fine. But since we did consent to recording this conversation, the other is a case called Liebemoff Enterprises against Husky, 666 F3rd 455, regarding an Indiana law prohibiting Indiana wine retailers from shipping wine to customers by common carriers, effectively outlawing what are the typical arrangements for wine clubs in the state of Indiana, where there was both a preemption and commerce clause challenge. All of us agreed the law should be upheld. Judge Posner wrote an opinion joined by Judge Sykes, and I wrote a separate concurrence disagreeing pretty fundamentally about methodology for dealing with those constitutional issues that I'd like to talk about a little bit, and I hope this helps illustrate some of the points here. The text of the Okay, we have an Indiana law that says if you sell wine and deliver it to customers, only your own retailer employees can make the delivery. You can't ship by UPS or the Postal Service. Section 2 of the 21st Amendment says the transportation or importation into any state, territory, or possession of the United States for delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof is hereby prohibited. Okay? Transportation or importation, intoxicating liquors for delivery or use therein, in violation of the laws thereof, it's prohibited as a matter of federal constitutional law. We faced in the challenge a federal preemption question involving a federal law that prohibits states from regulating the work of common carriers. And also a dormant commerce clause challenge because of the effects that this restraint, this state law has on the sale of alcoholic beverages, particularly from interstate shipments. Judge Posner, in his opinion for the majority, upheld the law by exercising what he described as judicial restraint. That is, when we get to the commerce clause issue, first, let's decide the Commerce Clause issue, and if and only if we decide there's a Commerce Clause problem, should we worry about the 21st Amendment? So he went through what those of you familiar with the Commerce Clause jurisprudence will know is the Pike balancing test, in which the issue is whether the burdens on interstate commerce substantially outweigh the benefits for the local government, the state government, is trying to achieve. And so, as you might imagine, that involves some of his kind of pragmatic cost-benefit analysis of the law. He ultimately found that there was no undue burden on interstate commerce after going through this, I think, quite pragmatic, practical, and policy-oriented evaluation of the Indiana law. I took a quite different approach that I think embodies a different view of judicial restraint, and I, if I may suggest one, a somewhat more pragmatic view of judicial restraint, although one that departed a little further from that went a little further from established precedent, at least, than I think my colleagues were willing to go. And what I said was, let's start with the 21st Amendment here, with its text and original intent. The state should have a showstopper of a defense here. The showstopper is this is a law regulating the transportation and importation of intoxicating beverages for consumption in the state of Indiana. That's core 21st Amendment analysis, core 21st Amendment territory, and we have no business injecting ourselves into an evaluation of the state's policy. The state is free to be parochial, protective, and benighted, if one will, in its approach to regulation of alcoholic beverages. I may think it's a bad idea as a wine drinker. I would love to be able to enjoy wine clubs, but that's not the way the power was allocated, as I understand it, from the 21st Amendment. and the process of going through the balancing test. If that's going to be part of litigation state alcoholic beverage regulations, the very process of litigating that balancing test is itself highly intrusive and burdensome in the affairs of the state government. I've helped defend state agencies before and have some idea of what's involved in, for example, trying to justify a perhaps unwise, parochial, protective piece of legislation. So litigating these balancing tests can impose significant demands on staff, time, and energy of the state government. It seemed to me that we ought to focus on the showstopper of the constitutional defense, the 21st Amendment, first. I think if you have the opportunity to read that case, what I would suggest is that it does teach us something about methodology and a little bit about constitutional theory as practiced by different judges. First, I think it shows that circuit and district judges can have trouble in applying constitutional law when the Supreme Court itself has strayed from original text and purpose, as it has in its 21st Amendment jurisprudence. This is especially so if the Supreme Court itself fails to come to grips with the problems and objections that it is overruling. I know that it's sometimes easier to wish certain problems away and not address them in a court opinion, particularly when you're writing by committee, as we do and as they do. But these problems will not go away when the further litigation comes along in the lower courts. I also learned from this opinion that Judge Posner, as pragmatic and policy-oriented as some critics may describe him, can parse judicial opinions with the best of them. Okay, we went at it hammer and tongs in our evaluation of the precedents took somewhat different views, but it was a fun debate. But there are also different dimensions of pragmatism as we're evaluating different kinds of rules that may be available. One kind of pragmatism that did come up in that particular case, ask yourselves, do we have a serious underage drinking problem with high-end great vintages out of Sonoma and Napa counties? I don't think that's the problem in Indiana, but nevertheless, that's where the Indiana legislature had aimed its legislation. We can't have kids drinking the high-end vintages anyway. Shipped through the mail on their parents' credit cards. But I was taking an approach a little bit different, that we need to look at, as I suggested, the consequences of litigation, the processes and intrusion that litigation produces. If we don't address the 21st Amendment issues until we've already concluded the law violates the Commerce Clause, ask yourself, we've just reached this conclusion. This is terrible. This is unconstitutional. Are we then going to say, oops, but all this exercise we've just gone through is for naught, and we're going to back off and say, no, the 21st Amendment trumps all this? I think the better approach is to go the other way. As Judge Easterbrook wrote in one of the key precedents on this, these kinds of cases pit the 21st Amendment, which appears in the Constitution, against the dormant Commerce Clause, which does not. And I prefer to start with the part that that does appear there. I will just say a little bit about the Alvarez audio taping case, and then we'll open up for time for questions. I don't want to take any more of your time on this. But I would say that Judge Sykes' opinion is a tour de force in judicial method. Precedent, doctrine, original meaning, of the First Amendment. It's, obviously it talks about speech and freedom of the press at the beginning, but what is implicit in that? Promise in our Constitution is the ability to gather information. It's not unlimited, but what we were talking about in the Alvarez case was the ability to make recordings of conversations that were being conducted in public and audible to the listener. As Judge Sykes pointed out, the Illinois law left observer and listener free to take still photos, take silent video, to lip read what is said, to take shorthand, or take notes, reconstruct what was happened. The only thing that it outlawed was the audio recording itself, which served really no legitimate purpose, at least as I viewed it, as applied to the work of police officers and others doing the public work in public. Judge Posner took a very different view, very troubled about intrusions on privacy, and went back to an original, much narrower understanding of the freedom of speech and press. I will conclude by saying that the lessons that I take from Judge Wilkinson are there is no dominant theory. You need to stick close to the facts. You need to be ready to parse doctrine as a litigator in these cases, and you need to be ready to address text and original meaning, and you need to be able to look at pragmatic consequences of the different legal rules, both for the parties and for others who will have to live under them. That's a pretty free-floating, wide-open range for litigation and adjudication. But remember, we do have to do it in public, and we have to explain ourselves to the reasonable satisfaction of the public and those of you in the profession who pay attention to us. We'll open up for questions and comments by others. Thank you very much.
Perhaps I speak for others when I acknowledge that at some level all practitioners are pragmatists in this regard. thank you both. Absolutely fascinating reflections on this very fascinating book, and certainly lots to chew on with regard to all of that. Now, I do want to take a couple of questions while you sort of gather your thoughts. Let me just throw one out at the beginning, which is, we seem to, with every confirmation hearing in the Supreme Court, encounter more and more judicial candidates who are much more express about rejecting things like living constitutionalism. And if they don't fully embrace originalism, they certainly speak in terms of textualism, and they hint that at least they're not averse to originalism. And I'm wondering, how should we take that development, especially in light of Judge Hamilton's observation that the judiciary needs to be concerned about public credibility?
I agree that originalism has enjoyed a significant measure of respect to the extent that it's now talked about in the context of confirmation hearings for Supreme Court justices and in other public discourse. It's not just the property of the legal academy, and so in that sense, Judge Bork's project has been extraordinarily successful. But in terms of the legitimacy of the judicial role, as I explained in my prepared remarks, that is one of the animating principles of originalist theory, that because the Constitution is law, because it's supreme law, because it's it needs to be interpreted as such, we ought to focus on text and structure and history the way we would interpret any other source of law, any other legal document like a statute. It bears many resemblances to statutory interpretation, accepted methods of statutory interpretation, and Judge Wilkinson talks about this in the book. And so it very much seeks to serve that legitimating process for the institution of judicial review by publicly explaining in a persuasive way why the claim in the case comes within the scope of the constitutional provision in question or does not, or why it applies in the way that it does. And I completely agree with what Judge Hamilton said about the need for implementing doctrine once we get our hands on the meaning and scope of the text. That's not going to answer all the questions. We obviously consider precedent, and we all consider the consequences of a decision one way or the other on the legal and political order. Those are all valid and important considerations, but the anchor is text, structure, and history for originalist judges and for originalist scholars. And as I explained in my remarks, in my judgment, that is most faithful to the justifications for the institution of judicial review?
It's a very interesting question, Tom, and I think I agree that those are the anchors, but I think that, and there is some real value to making those public anchors for the work that judges do. But I have to say that I think the oversimplified rhetoric between judicial restraint and judicial activism, which both words that tend to be used depending on whether you like the result or not, that's the way those words have come to be used in our public discourse. I don't think, for example, it is an exercise of judicial restraint when a court enforces the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the Eighth Amendment by imposing injunctive relief against a prison that has shown itself, its management has shown itself repeatedly unable to provide adequate health care and minimal necessities of life for prisoners. Everybody recognizes that that is an extraordinary step for a court to take. But if the federal courts are not willing to take it at some point with sufficient provocation, then we're abdicating our responsibilities. The rhetoric often used about wanting judges who apply the law, who don't make the law, is, I think, all of us recognize a vast oversimplification of the way courts actually work. And I think those of us in the profession, both lawyers and judges, do a disservice if we buy into that oversimplified rhetoric too readily, without explaining that, as any practicing lawyer and judge knows, there are situations where there is no controlling precedent or text, and you need to provide to develop law to fill in the interstices, to fill in the gaps. There is no way to take judgment out of judging. And the rhetoric that we have adopted in our public life, particularly in the confirmation process, too often seems to foster the fiction that we can. Now, I don't think the participants in that discussion are so unsophisticated as to believe the simple slogans, but the discussion goes on with those simple slogans, and that, I think, winds up doing a real disservice to the courts and to the nation in the long run.
Okay, let's hear from the audience. Who's got some questions? Stunned to silence.
While you're thinking, I have just one. I can jump in with one point in response to something that David said during his remarks. He talked about the counter-majoritarian difficulty in constitutional adjudication. And Judge Wilkinson talks about that in the book as well. And it's an important factor in cases arising under the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, the individual rights-based constitutional claims. It's not a difficulty that overcomes all else. Otherwise, we would be deferring in every case of an individual rights claim, and that's certainly inappropriate because that subordinates the constitutional guarantees to the ordinary law of statutes, both at the state and federal level, and that would be an inversion of the constitutional design. And so I don't know of any judge who subscribes to that sort of theory or practice, but it doesn't come into play in federalism cases, because federalism cases are all about the structural constitution. And so when the judiciary is presented with a constitutional claim based on the Commerce Clause or some other aspect of the structural constitution that allocates and checks authority as between the federal and the state governments, The counter-majoritarian difficulty is simply not in play because the judiciary is making a choice between which majority gets to make the decision. The majority at the federal level, in other words, the Congress, or the states. And so that distinction, I think, needs to be better understood among judges and among the general public, and especially in our current political moment when we have a popular constitutionalism that is out and about, for lack of a better term, in our political discussions, especially within the Tea Party. And so, you know, I think being clear about the institution of judicial review, what its basis is, how it operates, and the guiding principles for making these decisions when we talk about them in public context is extraordinarily important.
I hope I don't ask questions that hard during oral argument. But,
it's a great question.
At least to me, the breadth of that phrase implies a pretty broad power. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about what Congress is able to do, I think that I tend to find myself pretty much in the deferential mode, whether I like the current Congress or don't like the current Congress. And this is where I'm comfortable with Wilkinson's approach, that we need to interpret the Constitution in ways that give legislative majorities pretty broad power to address the changing problems that we face as a society. If you're asking if I'm headed in the general direction of agreeing with National Federation of Businesses against Sebelius, the answer is I like the bottom line. So, I hope that's responsive to your question. I think it's more of a more structure, relationship, and judicial competence. Particularly when we're dealing with broad economic and domestic policy issues, judges aren't very good at figuring this stuff out, and the text of the Constitution and the original intention was to provide a broad text and broad powers.
Yeah, and I agree with what David has said about that. This is an aspect of the structural constitution that I think is going to see much more action in litigation after the NFIB versus Sebelius case, the healthcare cases, because of the spending clause section of that decision. The clause says that the Congress can tax and spend for the general welfare, and Congress has used this authority capaciously and in all of its spending clause legislation, and that gets around the limits such as they are on the commerce power, because it allows the Congress through this theory of contracting with the states to do an awful lot that looks like regulation by way of the vast spending clause programs that the federal government sponsors in essentially a contract relationship with the states. And the healthcare case strengthened that conceptualization of spending clause legislation to the extent that it said that the expansion of the Medicaid program really violated the terms of the original contract with the states in the Medicaid Act so dramatically that it violated the spending clause. It constituted a form of commandeering and couldn't be sustained. And the remedy imposed was to invalidate the section of the Medicaid Act that allows the secretary to cut off all Medicaid funds if the states didn't agree to expand their program. So, I think we're going to see more activity in this area, and it is going to raise the structural and relationship issues that David referred to. And for those of us in the lower court who are going to have to be figuring out the limits of that conceptualization of this kind of congressional legislation, it's not going to be an easy job.
If I could add, I would say, with respect to the spending clause, the unconstitutional condition part of Sebelius, I'm still trying to figure out what this means, okay? Because it seems to grant a kind of constitutionally protected status to current legislation and funding arrangements. And I confess that I found Justice Ginsburg's dissent on that point very persuasive. So I don't know how much further the majority is willing to go in restricting legislative freedom to change funding arrangements. But we'll have to wait and see how that shakes out. I had not expected when I went on the court to wind up spending a lot of time learning about the Second Amendment or the spending clause, but I'm suspecting that those are going to be major parts of the jurisprudence that Judge Sykes and I are going to be working on for the foreseeable future. So.
Brian, how are we doing? One more. Yes.
Where do you think the notion of political context fits within the frameworks of constitutional interpretation? And by example, I found your discussion of the Husky case, which I think is the Wine case, fascinating, but it strikes me that the language of the 21st Amendment viewed within a political context is we're going to repeal prohibition, but quid pro quo over an enormous social issue of the time will grant to the states almost unfettered right to regulate. Now, some 80, 70 years later, the notion of prohibition seems remarkably archaic, but at the time, I suspect that my First Amendment was far more controversial. Does political context play a role in interpretation?
Sure. I think that's part of the original history of what you're trying to get at. One of those elementary lessons somebody taught me early on in the law, and certainly applies if you're on a court, is that you don't tear down a fence if you don't know why it was built there until you understand why it was built in the first place. Okay. And it may be that the Supreme Court has been engaged in a long-term project of tearing down that 21st Amendment fence. Professor Tanford, many of you know, has done a lot of these cases around the country and has reminded me that the Supreme Court, in considering these alcoholic beverage cases, has ruled against the states in either 15 out of 16 or 17 out of 18 over the last 40, 50 years. And what I was doing was definitely bucking the trend. But I think that the original quid pro quo that you've described is exactly what happened and should be respected. Now, it may be that in this respect, some people you would not suspect of being living constitutionalists have headed in that direction. So it's an interesting problem, but I think that the original context, the political compromises that were made to get that text into place, are vital and deserve our respect.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. Political context is incredibly important to illuminating the historical meaning of the Constitution's text. This came up on a number of occasions in questions of state constitutional law when I was on the state Supreme Court, and also in the right to bear arms context. Wisconsin amended its constitution in the mid-1990s to add a right to bear arms, and it was much more explicit than the Second Amendment and listed a whole laundry list of permitted purposes that citizens of Wisconsin had the right to bear arms for. So it was very, you know, textually clear that this was an individual right, but also based on the context by which, the political context by which this amendment was adopted, which was in the 1990s, you know, all of us on the court lived through it, so we knew very well what the political history was, and when we had the first two test cases, that factored very prominently in our analysis of the scope of the right and how it ought to be applied in individual cases.
Well, thank you both very much.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having us.
This is great. Thank you.